Yeah, baby, it's episode 135 of Ask the Inspector on February 13th, 2024, the day before Valentine's Day. Don't feel obligated to get me anything, Scott. I saw you gave the Colonel some chocolates, though. Hint, hint.
Well, I mean, chocolates are meant for the special people, but yes.
I refer, of course, to your Russian lover, Colonel Kadav. How do you say it? Kadakadovsky?
Kodakovsky. And if you call him my lover, A, he'll kill me the next time I see him, and B, he'll probably hunt you down and kill you too. So don't
all mess. All I know is you gave him chocolates, and I'll be looking to see what I get tomorrow on Valentine's Day.
I gave him chocolate and cigarettes. I gave him Lucky Strike cigarettes to be distributed amongst his troops, and Hershey's chocolate, because the old sea rations, they used to contain small packets of Lucky Strike cigarettes and the famous D ration, which was the chocolate ration, which was Hershey's chocolate. So in honor of trying to on waging peace, where we have the Americans and the Russians shaking hands on the Elbe, I was trying to, you know, sort of generate that kind of feeling by harking back to the past. So that's why, Jeff, they got chocolate.
All right. Very nice. We posted the interview or meeting, a conversation, whatever you want to call it, yesterday on all our channels, and just published today on Substack a little post you wrote about it. And there it is. You can read it at scottritterextra.com. The meeting with the Colonel, of course, is embedded in that post. And if you know how to get to our channels, you can just go there directly to watch it if you'd want. But here you get a few paragraphs from Scott describing. How did that meeting come to be?
Well, as I explained in the article, one of my goals of going to the new territories was to not just speak with political leaders, which I had great success at doing, and members of the government involved in the reconstruction of the territories, but also frontline commanders. I mean, I get a million questions about what's going on the front line. I'm like, well, I don't know. I'm in sort of Delmar, New York. it's quiet here. Maverick is on guard, but the front line. I'm a prisoner of the same source as everybody else is. You know, I read what they read. I look at the same videos they look at. I have a brain that's been tuned in a certain way that allows me to maybe pick details out and put things together. But I just thought it would be useful to meet with some frontline commanders. And so Alexander Zirianov, whom this program has interviewed and talked to, he was my host. He had reached out to a gentleman named Kirill, who was involved in taking food, clothing, non-lethal supplies to, soldiers on the front line. And apparently that's a thing. It happens all the time. Russian patriots gather the food from families and such, and then they make contact with different units and they drive in. Some get killed. I mean, because they are going to the red line. They are, and some get hit by artillery, some get hit by the drones. Kirill told a story about how he was taking a shipment to a unit that was near Robotino during the counteroffensive. And so he's there and they're like, rapidly unloading the truck and boom, here come the Ukrainians. And the Russians handed him an AK and said, well, right now you're not a civilian, you're a soldier. Get over there. That's your line of direction. Do what you got to do to stay alive, because things just got real interesting. And they held off the attack, and he said he never had to fire around, but he's like, yeah, we got pretty close. So I said, hey, could I do that? And he said, well, why not? Maybe not that close, but we'll see what we can do. So he had actually hooked up a meeting with five different commanders. I mean, some of them were, anybody who said, one was a Storm Z unit, which are the sort of the elite assault units, take heavy casualties, but they show the medal you got. Yeah, I'll show that medal. but the Storm Z unit, there's a couple special forces units, and then other units are just straight up line units. And the idea was to meet with the commanders and some of their soldiers and have conversations with them and just get a feel for the front, so that when I came back here and people asked me, so what do you think about the front, I could say, well, when I met with so and so. And we had those interviews all lined up. They were all ready. It was going to happen. But the Russian Ministry of Defense had different point of view. Their point of view was they didn't really want me in the new territories to begin with. Not because they don't trust me. I mean, I'm assuming they don't. But that they do trust me. But that they're just like, we think you you're better doing what you're doing right now, doing the analysis and stuff. We don't like the idea of you getting killed. It would be a bad look. And so they put the kibosh on me going out and meeting with these five guys. But we were able to get one of these, the commanders, Colonel Kotakovsky, the commander of the Vostok battalion, to come away from the front line and meet us in a area that was deemed safer. We didn't have that much time in Donetsk. The other thing that the Russian Ministry of Defense was like is, all right, if you're going to do this tour, it's in and out, buddy, in and out. Get in there, see what you need to see, and get the hell out of there. You're not hanging around. And so with the limited amount of time we had, we could get one guy out there. It was Colonel Kotakovsky. He agreed to the interview. I had talked to him before on the Scott Ritter show. He's one of the first, he was the first military commander that I spoke to. And it was just it was a fascinating thing. I was all prepped, man. I knew who he was. I've been following him. His unit has taken the lead in some innovative use of drones, and I was all ready to sit there and get into drone warfare talk. And next thing I know, we spent the entire time having a fascinating sort of political discussion, philosophical discussion, a very unique interview. I wouldn't trade it for anything, but it just wasn't the interview that I thought when I sat down, it wasn't the interview that I thought was going to happen.
Well, luckily, you're capable of going in any direction, and it was very heartwarming. Even though we haven't really touted this very much on this podcast or in the Substack post, it's already generating thousands and thousands of comments. People love it. So I'm sure the audience will double, if not triple or quadruple now that we're touting it even more. There it is, ScottRitterExtra.com. Check it out.
The other thing I would say is, how can one compete with Tucker Carlson? You can't. I mean, I think he's talking 300 million views or something like that. Knocked it out of the park. He was at Dubai, in a World Governance Council, just winning over an international audience about, what he did and the message. The message is you got to listen to Russia, and, Russia's, pretty cool, and maybe people should start paying attention to it and all that. A good message. Again, before I go on, Jeff, I owe you an apology.
What?
Yes, on what Friday.
Happened? What happened?
Apparently, I went blind with fury at Tucker Carlson or whatever I did. And I said something that was extraordinarily rude to you. I didn't realize it at the time, but Siri pointed it out. And on retrospect, she's 100% correct. I know you're a good friend of mine and you let it slide off like water off a duck's back, but for the sake of the viewing audience out there, I want you to know that I never talk to Jeff like that. I always show him the highest degree of respect, and I am a little bit of ashamed that I allowed my temper to put words out there like that. So I apologize to you in public. I hope you forgive.
Apology accepted, but Siri is my Valentine, not you. Tomorrow.
Siri is she's not my Valentine.
plus after you insulted me or right before you insulted me, you said no offense, which is kind of like with all due respect, then whatever follows that, you can say almost anything, even if it's the most offensive thing in the world. This is when this is after I was saying, that Tucker's monologue went on a bit too long for the average person. And actually, I have a little audio clip. So just so people have a little context here, they know what you're talking about.
You're going to do this, aren't you?
This is what Scott said to his good friend, Jeff, for which he just apologized.
But you weren't listening because, Jeff, no offense to you,
you were listening to that historical monologue and you were, your eyes were rolling because you're dumber than shit.
No offense. Well, no offense taken. Who would be no offended? Taken, who would possibly be offended by that?
Who could be offended by that? I mean, my goodness. No offense taken, right? Because I said
not,
no offense.
No, no, no. With all due respect, all you're the respect. Dumbest motherfucker I've ever met in my life. No offense.
I owe him a big bottle of wine. I don't know. Jeff, is the invitation to the Bob Dylan concert still on?
Well, if Siri doesn't want to go with me, then maybe. All right. Apology accepted. Don't worry about it. Let's get to the questions. This is the lightning round. We do it every Tuesday. Scott answers each question in 3 minutes or less. The first question is from X in Palestine. There was a side note there that the individual can't reveal his or her identity for obvious reasons. And here's the question. Israel is moving against Rafah, southern Gaza, where more than 1 million people are. If Israel goes in, is it possible they will be able to push the Palestinians out of Gaza? If yes, would that be the end of the resistance in Gaza and the Palestinian cause?
Well, I mean, it would be darn near fatal to the Palestinian cause. I mean, there's like 1.6 million Palestinians, Gazans, who are gathered in Rafah. Why? Because Israel's dropped leaflets all over Gaza telling them this is the safe place. This is where you need to go. But now we see the Israeli plan all along is to push them into Egypt. Now, the Egyptians have basically said, we're not going to allow that to happen. But, I mean, the bottom line is Israel's going to do what it's going to do until either the United States tells them you'll never see another penny from us, or Egypt says we're willing to go to war for this. This is a very dangerous situation. It's in terms of stopping the Palestinian resistance. Well, you know, Hamas is still underground and they're still popping up in Khan Yunis. They're popping up in Gaza City. Moving civilians around above ground does not end the Palestinian resistance. It would put a damper on it, but not end it. But if Israel is able to cleanse Gaza of civilians, then they've created a new, political dynamic, because they'll physically occupy Gaza and then they'll say they're not welcome back. And now the world has to deal with what they're going to do with, 1.6, 2 million new Palestinian refugees. The refugees now are refugees from their refugee camp. But yeah, it's an issue. It's a big issue. We'll see. I mean, we see South Africa going to the International Court of Justice now for an emergency injunction, because Israel clearly is telling the world, stick it in your ear. We're going to do whatever we want to do. They're committing a war crime, a literal war crime. And, the International Court of Justice said you have to stop doing anything that approaches genocide. Well, this is genocidal. So we'll see. There's a lot of legal, but Israel has basically said, we don't care. We don't care about anything and anybody. They would care about the United States if Joe Biden would make the phone call that only he is capable of making, but Israel owns the American body politic and that phone call will never come.
Okay. The next question comes from somebody, I swear somebody, and that is Figure Disfondo in Naples, Italy. A very romantic city. The U.S. dedicates an ungodly amount of its budget to military purposes. How much do you think that it's inflated due to crony capitalism, war profiteering, and general corruption?
I think you need to add another one, and they're just called incompetence, gross incompetence. I'm a big believer in gross incompetence. Is there corruption? I think there's a case ongoing about a Navy commander who fled, and I think he just got captured, brought back, but he it has a unique name to it, but he was doing some stuff out in the Pacific, just gross corruption. So I mean, is the U.S. military or officers and enlisted men who take the oath to defend the Constitution capable of this kind of criminal act? Yes, of course they are, but generally speaking they're not. Generally speaking they're honorable people. Yeah, I saw that old video. That's from October, but yeah, interesting video. crony cap. Look, the entire budget is crony capitalism. I mean, the way they break down military programs anymore, you know, you don't do the cost effective thing by consolidating all production into one production plant where you have a, you know, a singular workforce that can crank things out in a more efficient fashion with good oversight, et cetera. You have to break it up into 35 different states, farm it out. So that you spread the wealth. That's crony capitalism. There's cronies, Congress, capitalism, money, et cetera. So the, you know, yeah, we also have an accounting issue. You know, the Pentagon can't account for not hundreds of billions, but trillions of dollars. Just don't know where it is. So, I mean, this budget is out of control. I mean, we're spending money on stuff that we don't even know that where it is. We don't know where it's gone. We can't account for it. Everything we buy is overpriced, grossly overpriced, inefficiencies, et cetera. And we don't care because at the end of the day, it's U.S. taxpayer dollars going to congressional districts to enrich the shareholders of the military industrial complex. Who warned us about that? Oh, yeah, Dwight Eisenhower.
All right. The next question is from Sebastian in New York City. People always refer to the deep state without specificity as to who they are. Do you think Zionists have a relation to the deep state? And if so, what is that relation?
Well, I've talked about it before here. I the deep state, I just call it the blob. And I went through, you know, historically how it happened. I mean, when you have you know, a president moves in and out, he gets elected, then he leaves, another president comes in. But the people under that first presidency, you know, gain certain experiences in governance. These are the bureaucrats, unelected. And so most of them hang on for the second president and carry over that skill set. And then he brings in his own people. The other people go out and they get into the civilian sector, but they're brought in as advisors or come back later on. And you start creating this body of unelected governors. I don't mean governors with a big G. I mean governors as in people who are responsible for governance in the country. And then, you know, how do you train these people? Well, they go back to academia and they train a new generation. And so now you have this academic pillar out there. You have think tanks that operate where it become a repository for experts. So if I'm an expert under a Republican administration, a Democratic administration comes in, they have to keep me, you know, viable in the game. So I get a sinecure. I go off in this think tank. They pay me money and I criticize the policies of the Democrats. I keep my fingers in the game so that if next time a Republic comes in, I can slide right in. And it just grows and grows and grows. Every aspect of society has a link to government that involves money. And as soon as money is involved, it involves people wanting to make money. And this blob just grows and grows and grows. The Israelis, you know, part of the blob is the media. Now, what we've seen is the Israeli lobby, can't call it the Jewish lobby because that's anti-Semitic. Just say people sympathetic to Israel, many of whom are Jews, they control a large chunks of this blob. Why? Because they want to shape a world where Israel is never set aside as an afterthought, where Israel always gets the support it needs. And so they control all the levers of power. So yeah, I think in the short answer of that, yes, Israel is a big part of the so-called deep state.
Yeah, there are many Jews who sympathize with Palestine. Here's a recent demonstration in New York City, as a matter of fact, although they were stopping traffic, which I never like. I hate when people bother somebody who has nothing to, who aren't the culprits, you know what I mean? But anyway, that's a good indication of where some of the sentiment is among Jews. How about a voicemail message, speaking of New York, from my cousin Vinny? You'll recognize this gentleman. He's left us voicemail messages before. I love the way he talks.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I heard Nasrallah, the chief of Hezbollah, today give a speech. And he started off very light, and then he began to get hot. And the bottom line is, he laid it out very simple to Netanyahu: bring all your noise to Lebanon and find out what a surprise you will get in return. And if you attack Rafah border, that also will be a red line where you will be in imminent danger, you and your crew. How do you feel about that?
Well, good question. First of all, I like crew. This guy's from Northern Jersey or New York, man. But look, Nasrallah's already said this.
Eminent danger. That's how they say it in New York.
Eminent danger. Yeah, it's not personal. It's just business. But Nasrallah has said this in the past. He said, you know, we won't intervene unless you are in a position where you're threatening to destroy Hamas. Then we will have no choice to come in. Earlier question said, would pushing the Palestinian refugees out of Rafah, depopulating Gaza, be a threat? And the answer is yes, it is a threat. The fact of the matter is, you know, Nasrallah is reminding Netanyahu that there will be consequences to pay. If you attack Rafah, then that's a red line, and then you're at war with Hezbollah. And if you think you can handle, because the Israelis have been making a lot of talk about going up against Hezbollah, but they've been managing that. Then Hezbollah says, we're ready. And the thing is, Israel's not ready. I don't know what he said, glitch in the matrix. I'm responding to a question. I'm not pretending that I heard the speech. So I'm only responding to what I heard in the question. But I do know what he said back in October, and he said that if Israel threatens the existence of Hamas, threatens Hamas with defeat, that Hezbollah would intervene. So you can't challenge me on that one. But you know, I didn't hear the speech today, so I don't know. I'm just saying that if that's what Nasrallah said, if that's an accurate reflection of his words, he's merely making the same point that he made back in October.
All right, let's take a live phone call. I've got a couple people on hold here. Hey there, can you please lower your device? Thank you, and hello, good day, good evening. You're on with the weapons inspector.
Hello, I'm calling from Florida. My question is about two facts. The President Putin, in the interview with Carlson, mentioned twice President Zelensky and acknowledged that his father served the Soviet Union and served as a front soldier. The second thing is that President Zelensky fired Zaluzhny, who is a banderist and a nationalist. And he hired a tough guy, but who is a Russian. My question is Zelensky taking a life insurance if he has to negotiate with Russia? And is Russia giving him a little nod? That's what my question.
Well, first of all, I'll say I heard what President Putin said to Tucker Carlson. He did speak about Zelensky's father, but he misspoke. He meant Zelensky's grandfather. And I'm sure if you asked him, he would have said, oh, of course, the grandfather. It was the grandfather that fought against the Nazis and the Banderists, and not the father. But the firing of Zaluzhny, there's no doubt that Zaluzhny is a Ukrainian nationalist. He has a portrait of Stepan Bandera in his office. He is often seen giving medals out to members of the Azov Battalion or other. Yeah, you're right, Lady Hamilton's Cottage. So Zaluzhny, had these links. And if you saw in the, after Zelensky threatened to fire him, Zaluzhny immediately posed with a photograph with one of the far-right sector Nazis, giving him a medal, and they posed not only with the portrait of Bandera, but next to it was a Right Sector flag. So Zaluzhny was making it clear where his loyalties stand. Sirsky is a Russian, you know, but he's also a very loyal Ukrainian. I mean, he's been fighting for the Ukrainian cause from the very beginning. 2014, he was the commander of a battle in the Donetsk-Lugansk region, Debaltsvoye, I believe it was. It was a big defeat for the Ukrainians, and it was the battle that prompted the French and the Germans to intervene to save thousands of Ukrainian soldiers that were surrounded by the Russians and the Russian separatists. Sirsky was the commander there. Sirsky, you know, led the successful defense of Kiev, and he led the Kharkov counterattack, and he got a good reputation there being an aggressive fighter. He also was responsible for the battles of Bakhmut, feeding troops into the meat grinder, and for the counteroffensive. And now he's taken over not just, you know, the battle for Avdiivka. I have trouble with that word, but and, you know, and now he has command of the entire military. You know, is he a nationalist? He's been fighting for a nationalist cause. I mean, let's just not pretend that this guy doesn't know what he's doing. He's not fighting for Ukraine. He's fighting for a nationalist cause. And you can't become the commander of the Ukrainian armed forces unless you're willing to, you know, continue the policies and the practices that empower these Nazis. So I don't think anybody's given anybody a wink and a nod. Zelensky's on his way out. He's desperate. He's scared. You know, he's hoping Sirsky was popular amongst the Russian military. And so he's hoping by putting Sirsky in that, that he'll avoid a coup d'etat.
All right. Let me try to stop it before the next whip goes. Yes. Got it. All right. The next question is from Trump won Michigan in Lansing, Michigan. What are the chances that a disgruntled Victoria Nuland and other players in the State Department will try and have Tucker Epstein now? That's a verb, Epstein. I believe that Tucker is going to be targeted more heavily now, and they're going to go all out to shut him down and shut him up.
Well, first of all, Nuland just doesn't have that kind of power. She's a member of the State Department, and she just doesn't have the kind of power. You know, she can make policy, she can influence policy, she can do things in policy circles. But, you know, as much as we talk about the deep state and all that, the idea of a acting deputy secretary of state picking up the phone and calling the CIA or calling the FBI and trying to Epstein Tucker. No, I don't see that happening. This would have to come from higher than her. And it would have to be done in a manner that, that protects.
What does Epstein him mean? I mean, does it mean kill him or does it mean prosecute him or both?
I think it's a combination. I think it means destroy his reputation. So to become, so he you know, could be arrested and have his reputation smeared and end up in jail and get hung, get killed, get removed.
He's too big. He's too big.
The thing is, unless Tucker does something really, really stupid, like visit Epstein Island, the man is too big right now. The best course of action for the U.S. government is to ignore him, because to target him like that, all you're going to do is it's going to become out of control. It's not going to work. So no, I think Tucker's too big to fail right now. I think he's what he's done is it's a hell of an accomplishment. I mean, 300 million views and growing. It's stunning.
Too big to fail. That's the line right there. Ahmed in Morocco. We agree the most powerful weapon the Palestinian resistance has is the tunnel network. Why didn't the Israelis develop a tunnel warfare doctrine since they knew this? And they already took heavy casualties in the 2014 war because of it.
Well, I believe they did develop a tunnel warfare doctrine. I mean, they, you know, they studied the 2014 tunnels. My understanding is that they built replicas of these tunnels and they're, special forces practice tunnel operations. But the scope and scale of the tunnels is just beyond imagination. I mean, 500, you know, I think it's 500 kilometers of tunnels. The Israelis have acknowledged, you know, breaching maybe 20%, but they don't know. You know, it's just a matter of force availability. I mean, they did that. You know, they dropped 2,000-pound bombs, which are designed to penetrate, you know, concrete and earth in an effort to collapse tunnels. And they've been dropping a whole bunch of them to try and collapse these tunnel networks. So there's been some sort of thought process there. But Hamas isn't dumb, and they know what weapons the Israelis have, and they just went deeper. I think that's the reality, is Hamas just went deeper. And the Israelis haven't been able to cope with that.
Okay. Zaki B in Mexico. You're older and wiser now, and you have a brand new haircut too, we should point out. Has your view of Saddam Hussein changed as your view of Israel has changed? Maybe now you can empathize with him more. Also, would you ever write a book about the Palestinian cause? You have a big following of Palestinians everywhere.
Well, I am older. Wiser is a debatable question. I don't, I mean, Zaki, with all due respect, I got to be careful what I say here, with all due respect, but.
no offense, Zaki, but that's the dumbest fucking question I've ever
known. No. But I would say that you probably have a limited understanding of my, you know, what I think of Saddam Hussein. I actually was somebody who believed that Saddam Hussein represented the greatest force of stability in Iraq, that our efforts to remove him from power were short-sighted and self-destructive, that Saddam was working hard to, you know, to build a viable Iraqi state that, you know, had no viability built into it. I mean, the split between the Shia, the Sunni, and the Kurds was real from the very beginning, predated Saddam. I've not been anti-Saddam at all. I mean, I remember when I was pulled out of the amphibious warfare school and sent to the warfighting center, Major General Matt Caulfield called me, and I was supposed to help plan some operations in Iraq. And we were having a discussion, and he said, "Well, what do you think?" And I said, "About what?" And he said, "Well, about what's going on." I said, "Well, sir, we're fighting the wrong Arabs." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "The bad guys here are the Kuwaitis. The bad guys are the Saudis. The Iraqis are the good guys. You know, we're fighting the wrong Arabs, but you know, we got to do what we got to do." I've never had this anti-Iraqi thing. As a weapons inspector, I think a lot of people misconstrue the fact that I was single-minded in my pursuit of weapons of mass destruction, pursuit of the truth, and that the Iraqis were an obstacle to me getting the truth. And so, you know, I was very aggressive towards them, but that didn't mean that I felt that Saddam Hussein was this brutal thug dictator who had to be removed at all cost. He may have been a brutal thug dictator, but he was an Iraqi dictator. And maybe at that time, that's what Iraq needed to get out of the mess that the British had made when they drew the lines on a map and build a viable nation state. About the Palestinians, I'd love to write a book about the Palestinian cause, but I'll tell you this, it would require me to travel and do some research and talk to some people. Maybe when the situation calms down, I can do that. You know, I'd love to go to Palestine, to a free and independent Palestine, and have conversations with the people who are going through this experience today.
Let's take another phone call. Hey there, you're on with our favorite weapons inspector on the lightning round. Are you there?
Hi, yeah. Yes. Hi.
Well, good. Now comes the part where you ask the question.
Yeah, sure. So, so after watching the Tucker interview, it sort of confirmed my suspicions that there is sort of an element of American society that wants to view Russia as like another white Christian state instead of the Banderist view, and the goal would be to unite with it to attack China. So how widespread is this view, and why do people still have this view even after America has done everything against both of these countries? Thanks.
Okay, thank you. I can't believe that caller was so rude as to have his dog barking in that.
I know.
I know.
That's terrible.
With all due respect, caller, if you can't control your dog, well, that was my dog. But I know what he's saying. I mean, there. First of all, there's, you know, we talk about Russophobia on the show because it's, I mean, it's real. It exists in America, but there is a Sinophobia as well. And Tucker Carlson is a living, breathing manifestation of Sinophobia. It's amazing how Tucker talked about going to Russia and he was shocked by what he saw in Moscow, the clean subways and trains that run on time. I don't know if we're allowed to say that, but, you know, but infrastructure that worked and people that were, you know, dedicated and all this stuff. I would imagine that, if he went to China, he would see the same thing. Everybody I've spoken to who's gone to China has just come back and said, wow, what a thing. So, I mean, you know, let's just be honest. Tucker was ignorant about Russia till he went to Russia, and he's ignorant about China till he goes to China. So I would encourage Tucker Carlson to go to China and maybe have some of the, scales lifted from his eyes. This whole white Christian thing, look, they're misconstruing the Russians. The Russians, as Vladimir Putin said, you know, you can't pick your neighbors. We have China. That's a reality. And we've learned to deal with that reality. And right now we have good relations with China. We've built trade. We're doing well by each other. And that's not going to change. No one's going to drive a wedge between us. That just isn't going to happen. Some people take a look at, you know, in America, the conservatives, white Christians, they talk about family values and all that stuff. And they look at Russia and they see Russian talking about family values. And so they say, oh, we're one and we're the same. No, Russian Orthodoxy is not the same as American evangelical Christianity. Two totally different beasts, not related. And they're not going to come together in common cause because the Russian faith is a different kind of faith than the American faith. And they're just not going to use that as a springboard into making common cause against China.
Nicholas in Sweden. To me, it looks like Russia is shaping the battlefield right now. So we may see a bigger offensive in the coming months. Is this correct? Or are they not shaping the battlefield in preparation?
Well, I mean, the Russians have been shaping the battlefield this entire time. The whole concept of a war of attrition is basically shaping the battlefield. You shape it by creating the situation where you can get unequal casualty results. The Russians at some point in time, they were talking about 1-7, meaning for every one dead Russian, 7 dead Ukrainians. In October, that number was hovering around 1-10. Today, some of these units that I was talking about that I was going to interview, they're talking about 1-20. One dead Russian, 20 dead Ukrainians is outlandish. That's shaping the battlefield. The Russians are basically inside the decision-making cycle of the Ukrainians. They're getting the Ukrainians to commit reserves where the Russians want them to commit reserves. They're getting them to mass forces where the Russians want them to mass forces, like today, where they brought in 2 Iskander missiles on a bunch of troops that are being assembled to launch a counterattack against Avdiivka. You're talking about 200 dead, 300 wounded. Those numbers are going to go up. You know, they basically took out a couple of battalions right there. Boom. And that's how Russia's been doing this battlefield for some time now. So they're shaping the battlefield. And when they basically have the Ukrainians where they want them, then the Russians will make the advances that are supportable by their force structure. Right now, the Russians are advancing. They're taking 500 meters here, 1.5 kilometers there, all along the front. They're just chewing. The Ukrainians can't stop them. Normally, what would happen is if the Russians advanced, the Ukrainians would counterattack and you'd get this positional back and forth. The Russians are advancing now. The Ukrainians don't have any reserves left. So the Ukrainians have to fall back and then wait for the Russians to advance again. And eventually, the Russians are going to deplete the Ukrainian forces to the point where the Ukrainians have nothing to fall back on. And that's where you'll start getting the Russian, you know, penetration and exploitation stuff. But no, Russia's been shaping this battlefield for some time now.
Blair S. in Sydney. Do you think Israel is holding the world at ransom with the Samson option?
No, the Samson option isn't meant for that. The Samson option is meant if the Arabs are overrunning Israel and Israel is going to be
wiped off the face of the earth. The Samson option basically says that we will take everybody down with us. Right now, Israel is not in danger of getting wiped off the face of the earth. Even if Egypt goes into Rafah and Hezbollah, you know, goes into Galilee, it's not the end of Israel. Now, if Iran developed a nuclear weapon, you know, that could be a different story. But, you know, there's no evidence that Iran has a nuclear weapon. Moreover, the Israelis, you know, have, you know, some, there was some hint that they may preemptively use nuclear weapons against Iran. And Pakistan let it be known that if they did that, there would be a likelihood that a Pakistani nuclear weapon would hit Israel. So that takes any kind of deviation from the Samson option, like a, you know, Israeli nuclear preemption off the table. I think the Israeli nuclear deterrence is, again, there as the Samson option, meaning that if Israel is getting overrun, if it's the end of Israel, they take everything down. Other than that, I don't see any scenario where Israel uses its nuclear weapons.
Okay. I see people are asking what the phone number is. I just want to explain. When I see there are already people on hold, I don't encourage others to call because I don't want make people to just sit on hold for a long time and never even get on. So that's the reason we only give out the number once in a while. But since you asked, that is the... Thank you, Yelena. Since you asked, that is the phone number. All right, let's take a call. Somebody has been waiting for a while here. Hey there, you're on with our favorite weapons inspector.
Hello.
Hello, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for taking the call, Jeff and Scott.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling.
So my question is for Scott there. Scott, you've made a career out of wargaming, and it looks like this battle here in Ukraine is going to be coming to an end here soon. And I was just interested in your thoughts about, if we talk about the deep state, their plans, and, you know, they're not going to obviously give up now failing in Ukraine. Can you see this war expanding to Finland and Sweden, and your thoughts on the possibilities of World War III?
No, thank you for the question. Look, right now there's a couple of realities that we have to deal with. One, the NATO is not going to attack Russia. If there was going to be a NATO intervention in Ukraine, it would have happened a while ago. NATO won't attack Russia. And if NATO doesn't attack Russia, then Russia will never attack NATO. Vladimir Putin made that point. Are you going to attack Poland? He said, only if a Poland attacks us first. Are you going to attack Finland? Only if Finland attacks us first. Sweden. Sweden attacks us, we attack Sweden. And since NATO's not going to attack Russia, Russia's not going to attack NATO. So this right now, what we're seeing is a lot of panic mongering to justify military expenditures, to justify policies that can sustain military expenditures. But the reality is Europe's sort of past that right now. Germany's economy is collapsing. They're deindustrializing as we speak, and France is headed in that direction. All of Europe's headed in that direction. And how can you militarize with a deindustrialized society? So I think what we're seeing right now is the deep state that has, you know, premised much of its actions on this Russophobia, the fear of Russia, the need to have Russia positioned as an enemy, is going to have to recalibrate, and they're fully capable of recalibrating. But I think because they're about surviving. The other thing we have to understand is the only principle the deep state has is money. That's the only principle, money and power. There's no principle about anti-communism, this, that. Heck, we were enemies of Vietnam. We're friends of Vietnam. We were against the Chinese. We were for the Chinese. Now we're against the Chinese. Russia, well, we've been pretty consistent in that one. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, the deep state will just have to recalibrate and come up with a policy direction that, you know, keeps the money flowing into the shareholders of the companies that the deep state is trying to prop up. Of course, these are primarily defense industries, but there's other companies as well, you know, BlackRock, and you know, conglomerates such as that. I think I answered the question.
Okay, here's another phone call. Hey there, you're on with our favorite weapons inspector. What's on your mind?
Hello?
Hello, time to talk.
Hey there. Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure.
Yeah, I've been watching the show for a little bit, and yeah, my question is very like concise and clear. I'm curious, what do we need to do as a nation with Israel? I mean, clearly they have a lot of influence over our politics, and people are saying that, you know, there's a dual citizenship going on where they could serve our country and theirs, and just want to get your thoughts on that.
Okay, thanks.
Well, thanks. Look, I mean, there's what I'd like to happen, which is we divorce ourselves from all things Israel and hit the reset button in the Middle East so that Israel doesn't own our policymakers, that the Palestinian people have equality with whatever we call the state of Israel. But this would require such a gross fundamental, when I say gross, I mean big, fundamental recalibration of everything we do, not only from a foreign policy standpoint, but from a domestic policy standpoint, that it's really unrealistic. The bottom line is, what we need to do is change our relationship with Israel so that they no longer have the guarantee of an automatic veto in the United Nations, so that they are accountable to international law, just like every other nation, so that we don't treat them as the equals of the United States, but as a sovereign state that has its own sovereign interests that may not coincide with ours. And when they don't coincide with ours, we act in the best interests of the United States. I'm not talking about the destruction of Israel. No matter how desirable that might be in some circles, it's unrealistic. But I am talking about a restructuring of the relationship with Israel. And in doing so, to create the conditions where we actually support a viable Palestinian state, not this demilitarized, neutered nation that Biden's talking about, where, you know, they don't have the ability to defend themselves and we get to pick their political leaders. That's not a sovereign state. Palestine should have the same right of self-defense as every other nation state. And, that means if Israel is going to build a military of certain capacity, then Palestine has to be able to build a military to defend against that capacity. So that's the direction I'd like to see us going, is one that's realistic, that can be achieved. I mean, I know some people get mad at me. No, you can't ever support Israel. Well, you know, guys, what I'm trying to tell you is there's reality and then there's fantasy. In the fantasy world, I'm with you, man. I don't know if you've been listening to me. I'm hammering Israel. I'm dead set against Israel. I view them as the personification of evil. I have part two of my Sympathy for the Devil article coming out. And guess who the devil is? Hint, hint. I'm not sitting here, overflowing with joy about the reality, but the reality is Israel exists and is going to continue to exist. What we need to do is find a way to make an Israel that can exist in peace with its neighbors, inclusive of a free and independent Palestinian state.
All right. Based on the caller ID I'm looking at, we have an international call here, Scott. The country code is 46. Do you know what country that is? Want to take a guess? I have no idea.
I'll guess. Go ahead.
I'm going to guess Germany. I have no idea, though.
Okay.
Oh, I thought you might guess too, but all right, let's just go to the call. Hey there, you're on with our favorite weapons inspector. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Sweden.
Sweden.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for spending the dime on us.
Of course, man. Of course. You guys deserve it. I have a question for Scott. I would like to know, how do you see the prospects in Gaza unfolding? Like, do you think that the war is going to expand and he's going to go into Rafah? and the war is going to expand, or do you think that a ceasefire will eventually be implemented?
I believe a ceasefire is going to be implemented, just because there's enough people in Israel in the right places that understand the reality of what will happen to Israel if they go into Rafah. You know, do you really want to tear up the Camp David Accords? Do you want to create a situation where Egypt is no longer in a permanent state of peace with Israel, but becomes a nation preparing for war with Israel and maybe even engaging in an armed conflict with Israel? Egypt's moving forces towards the border, and I don't think they're bluffing. You know, Hezbollah has made it clear that the consequences of expanding the conflict would be, you know, painful, if not fatal, to Israel. And so I think there's enough people who realize that, you know, that this war has to come to an end, that there has to be a ceasefire. But as long as Benjamin Netanyahu is holding on to power and holding on to his existence, literal, his existence as a free man, because once he resigns, he'll be arrested. He's going to trial, and he's probably going to jail unless they give him immunity. So I think everything here, you know, we're looking at Rafah, we're looking at Hezbollah, we're looking at all that. But really the question is, how long can Netanyahu hold out? At what point in time will the bottom drop out from his government and he will be deplatformed? Because once he's deplatformed, I think you'll see rapid movement towards a ceasefire. But you're not going to see a ceasefire as long as Benjamin Netanyahu is in power as prime minister.
Well, the time has come for the coin giveaway, which I didn't even mention today, although I know Yelena flashed it on the screen a couple of times. But people are so accustomed to it by now. We have over 500 people who have entered the drawing. That's okay, Yelena. We don't need to. Well, all right, it doesn't matter. Scott went to Russia in May. And at that point, he gave out this coin. And then when he returned in January, he gave out this coin. And as we've been doing, we're going to let the winner of the coin decide which of the two they want. So let us get right to it. 579 people have entered. And let's do the drawing. 584, 588. Did you
hear 900? Here's 600. Going what? Oh, wait.
595?
Five more. We can do 600. We hit the 600 threshold. There it is.
600. There it is. Okay. 608. Whoa, people are going wild.
Well, 612. Let's give it a couple minutes. I mean, we don't have to rush this thing.
I guess not. I don't know how fascinating it is for the audience to watch that number go up, but it's amusing to us, I suppose. 629, 632.
It's 650. We'll roll it. It's 650.
All right. All right. 650 is it. 648 is going to be in a few seconds then.
There it is.
All right. Boom. All right. We did it. Let's do the drawing now.
Rani Yagi.
All right. Congratulations to Rani Yagi. Send us an email, info@ustourofduty.org, and let us know what your address is, and we will send the coin to you. Remember, you got to tell us which of the two coins you want. You can buy the first one at scottrittermerch.com. That's this one. And you can also buy Scott's latest book, Disarmament in the Time of Perestroika. Try saying that five times fast. And that, by the way, is autographed by the author himself. And you also have a couple of t-shirts for sale there. So that'll do it for this week's episode of The Lightning Round. Thanks to Yelena for handling backstage duties. Thanks, as always, to our beloved audience and to our favorite weapons inspector. We'll be back on Friday night for the loquacious version, right? As regular schedule this week, Scott?
Yes. Yep. We're good.
All right.
With all due respect, I mean, I'll be there.
All right. No offense. No offense.
No offense taken.
And before we go, I just want to remind people one more time to check out Scott's latest Substack post, which includes an interview with the Colonel And that's at scottritterextra.com. And don't be shy about subscribing. A lot of great content. And we appreciate your support. So thank you.
I have to tell you, my interviewing skills must be really, really good. Did you see how exhausted the colonel looks? I mean,
no, I didn't notice. Let me take another look. Is that the look of fatigue?
the funny thing is, after we took this photograph, he smiled. I mean, he has a great smile and everything, but that's his relaxed face, and it scares the hell out of me. So,
yeah, he flashed a smile and he hugged you. That was very nice.
Yeah. No, we got the brothers in arms thing going, but that face would, I mean, if he ever called me in, you know, on the carpet for like, you know, if I did something, I'd be really, really worried.
He's capable of smiling, but he's also capable of the stern look.
The stern look.
All right. So be careful. All right, everybody. Thanks a lot. We'll see you on Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern time. Take care now.